Chapter 9. Leave Takings. The outer courtyard was in ordered turmoil when Rand finally reached it with his saddlebags and the bundle containing the harp and flute. The sun climbed toward midday. Men hurried around the horses, tugging at saddle girths and pack harness, voices raised. Others darted with last-minute additions to the pack saddles, or water for the men working, or dashed off to fetch something just remembered. But everyone seemed to know exactly what they were doing and where they were going. The guard walks and archers' balconies were crowded again, and excitement crackled in the morning air. Hooves clattered on the paving stones. One of the pack horses began kicking, and stablemen ran to calm it. The smell of horses hung thick. Rand's cloak tried to flap in the breeze that rippled the swooping hawk banners on the towers, but his bow, slung across his back, held it down. From outside the open gates came the sounds of the Ammerlin's pikemen and archers forming up in the square. They had marched around from a side gate. One of the trumpeters tested his horn. Some of the warders glanced at Rand as he walked across the courtyard. A few raised eyebrows when they saw the Heron-marked sword, but none spoke. Half wore the cloaks that were so queasy-making to look at. Mondarb, Land's stallion, was there, tall and black and fierce-eyed, but the man himself was not, and none of the Aes Sedai, none of the women, were in evidence yet either. Moraine's white mare, Aldeeb, stepped daintily beside the stallion. Rand's bay stallion was with the other group on the far side of the courtyard with Ingtar, and a bannerman holding Ingtar's gray owl banner, and 20 other armored men with lances tipped with 2 feet of steel, all mounted already. The bars of their helmets covered their faces, and golden surcoats with the black hawk on the chest hid their plate and mail. Only Ingtar's helmet had a crest, a crescent moon, above his brow, points up. Rand recognized some of the men. Rough-tongued Uno with a long scar down his face and only one eye. Ragan and Massima. Others who had exchanged a word or played a game of stones. Ragan waved to him, and Uno nodded. But Massima was not the only one who gave him a cold stare and turned away. Their pack horses stood placidly, tails swishing. The big bay danced as Rand tied his saddlebags and bundle behind the high-cantled saddle. He put his foot in the stirrup and murmured, "Easy, Red," as he swung into the saddle. But he let the stallion frisk away some of his stable-bound energy. To Rand's surprise, Loyal appeared from the direction of the stables, riding to join them. The Ogier's hairy fetlocked mount was as big and heavy as a prime Durin stallion. Beside it, all the other animals looked the size of Bella. But with Loyal in the saddle, the horse seemed almost a pony. Loyal carried no weapon that Rand could see. He had never heard of any Ogier using a weapon. Their steading were protection enough. And Loyal had his own priorities, his own ideas of what was needed for a journey. The pockets of his long coat had a telltale bulge, and his saddlebag showed the square imprints of books. The Ogier stopped his horse a little way off and looked at Rand, his tufted ears twitching uncertainly. "I didn't know you were coming," Rand said. "I think you would have had enough of traveling with us. This time there's no telling how long it will be or where we will end up." Loyal's ears lifted a little.
"There was no telling when I first met you either. Besides, what held then holds now. I can't let the chance pass to see history actually weave itself around Taviran, and to help find the horn."
Matt and Perrin rode up behind Loyal and paused. Matt looked a little tired around the eyes, but his face wore a bloom of health.
"Matt," Rand said, "I'm sorry for what I said. Perrin, I didn't mean it. I was being stupid."
Matt only glanced at him, then shook his head and mouthed something to Perrin that Rand could not hear. Matt had only his bow and quiver, but Perrin also wore his axe at his belt, with its big half-moon blade balanced by a thick spike.
"Matt? Perrin? Really, I didn't..."
They rode on toward Ingtar.
"That is not a coat for traveling, Rand," Loyal said.
Rand glanced down at the golden thorns climbing his crimson sleeve and grimaced. Small wonder Matt and Perrin still think I'm putting on airs. On returning to his room, he had found everything already packed and sent on. All of the plain coats he had been given were on the pack horses, so the servants said. Every coat left in the wardrobe was at least as ornate as the one he wore. His saddlebags held nothing in the way of clothes but a few shirts, some wool stockings, and a spare pair of breeches. At least he had removed the golden cord from his sleeve, though he had the red eagle pin in his pocket. Lan had meant it for a gift, after all. "I'll change when we stop tonight," he muttered. He took a deep breath. "Loyal, I said things to you I should not have, and I hope you'll forgive me. You have every right to hold them against me, but I hope you won't."
Loyal grinned, and his ears stood up. He moved his horse closer.
"I say things I should not all the time. The elders always said I spoke an hour before I thought."
Suddenly Lan was at Rand's stirrup, in his gray-green scaled armor that would make him all but disappear in forest or darkness.
"I need to talk to you, sheepherder."
He looked at Loyal.
"Alone, if you please, builder."
Loyal nodded and moved his big horse away.
"I don't know if I should listen to you," Rand told the warder. "These fancy clothes and all those things you told me, they didn't help much."
"When you can't win a big victory, sheepherder, learn to settle for small ones. If you made them think of you as something more than a farm boy who'll be easy to handle, then you won a small victory. Now be quiet and listen. I've only time for one last lesson, the hardest. Sheathing the sword."
"You spent an hour every morning making me do nothing but draw this bloody sword and put it back in the scabbard. Standing, sitting, lying down, I think I can manage to get it back in the sheath without cutting myself."
"I said listen, sheepherder," the warder growled. "There will come a time when you must achieve a goal at all costs. It may come in attack or in defense, and the only way will be to allow the sword to be sheathed in your own body."
"That's crazy," Rand said. "Why would I ever—"
The warder cut him off.
"You will know when it comes, sheepherder. When the price is worth the gain and there is no other choice left to you. That is called sheathing the sword. Remember it."
The Amarlin appeared, striding across the crowded courtyard with Lyanna and her staff, and Lord Aglomar at her shoulder. Even in the green velvet coat, the Lord of Faldara did not look out of place among so many armored men. There was still no sign of the other Aes Sedai. As they went by, Rand caught part of their conversation.
"But, Mother," Aglomar was protesting, "you've had no time to rest from your journey here. Stay at least a few days more. I promise you a feast tonight such as you could hardly get in Tarvalen."
The Amarlin shook her head without breaking stride.
"I cannot, Aglomar. You know I would if I could. I had never planned to remain so long, and matters urgently require my presence in the White Tower. I should be there now."
"Mother, it shames me that you come one day and leave the next. I swear to you, there will be no repetition of last night. I have tripled the guard on the city gates as well as the keep. I have tumblers in from the town and a bard coming from Mos Sharara. Why, King Esau will be on his way from Falmoran. I sent word as soon as—"
Their voices faded as they crossed the courtyard, swallowed up by the din of preparation. The Amarlin never as much as glanced in Rand's direction. When Rand looked down, the warder was gone and nowhere to be seen. Loyal brought his horse back to Rand's side.
"That is a hard man to catch and hold, isn't he, Rand? He's not here, then he's here, then he's gone, and you don't see him coming or going."
"Sheathing the sword," Rand shivered. "Warders must all be crazy."
The warder the Amarlin was speaking to suddenly sprang into his saddle. He was at a dead gallop before he reached the wide standing gates. She stood watching him go, and her stance seemed to urge him to go faster.
"Where is he headed in such a hurry?" Rand wondered aloud.
"I heard," Loyal said, "that she was sending someone out today, all the way to Arad Doman. There is word of some sort of trouble on Almuth Plain, and the Amarlin seat wants to know exactly what. What I don't understand is why now. From what I hear, the rumors of this trouble came from Tarvalen with the Aes Sedai."
Rand felt cold. Egwene's father had a big map back at home, a map Rand had pored over more than once, dreaming before he found out what the dreams were like when they came true. It was old, that map, showing some lands and nations the merchants from outside said no longer existed. But Almuth Plain was marked, butting against Toman Head.
"We will meet again on Toman Head,"
It was all the way across the world, he knew, on the Arith Ocean.
It has nothing to do with us, he whispered. Nothing to do with me.
Loyal appeared not to have heard. Rubbing the side of his nose with a finger like a sausage, the Ogier was still peering at the gate where the warder had vanished.
If she wanted to know, why not send someone before she left Tarvalin? But you humans are always sudden and excitable, always jumping around and shouting.
His ears stiffened with embarrassment.
I am sorry, Rand. You see what I mean about speaking before I think. I'm rash and excitable sometimes myself, as you know.
Rand laughed. It was a weak laugh, but it felt good to have something to laugh at.
Maybe if we lived as long as you, Ogier, we'd be more settled.
Loyal was 90 years old. By Ogier standards, not old enough by 10 years to be outside the steading alone. That he had gone anyway was proof, he maintained, of his rashness. If Loyal was an excitable Ogier, Rand thought most of them must be made of stone.
Perhaps so, Loyal mused. But you humans do so much with your lives. We do nothing but huddle in our steading. Planting the groves, and even the building, were all done before the long exile ended.
It was the groves Loyal held dear, not the cities men remember the Ogier for building. It was the groves planted to remind Ogier builders of the steading that Loyal had left his home to see.
Since we found our way back to the steading,
His words trailed off as the Ammerlin approached. Ingtar and the other men shifted in their saddles, preparing to dismount and kneel, but she motioned them to stay as they were. Lyanna stood at her shoulder, and Agumar a pace back. From his glum face, he appeared to have given up trying to convince her to remain longer. The Ammerlin looked at them one by one before she spoke. Her gaze stayed on Rand no longer than on any other.
"Peace favor your sword, Lord Ingtar," she said finally. "Glory to the builders, loyal Kisaran."
"You honor us, mother. May peace favor Tarvalin."
Ingtar bowed in his saddle, and the other Shinarans did too.
"All honor to Tarvalin," Loyal said, bowing.
Only Rand and his two friends on the other side of the party stayed upright. He wondered what she had said to them. Lyanna's frown took in all three of them, and Agumar's eyes widened, but the Ammerlin took no notice.
"You ride to find the Horn of Valir," she said. "And the hope of the world rides with you. The horn cannot be left in the wrong hands, especially in dark friend hands. Those who come to answer its call will come whoever blows it, and they are bound to the horn, not to the light."
There was a stir among the listening men. Everyone believed that those heroes called back from the grave would fight for the light. If they could fight for the shadow instead... The Ammerlin went on, but Rand was no longer listening. The Watcher was back. The hair stood on the back of his neck. He peered up at the packed archers' balconies overlooking the courtyard, at the rows of people jammed along the guard walks atop the walls. Somewhere among them was the set of eyes that had followed him unseen. The gaze clung to him like dirty oil.
It can't be a fade, not here. Then who, or what?
He twisted in his saddle, pulling Red around, searching. The bay began to dance again. Suddenly, something flashed across in front of Rand's face. A man passing behind the Ammerlin cried out and fell, a black-fletched arrow jutting from his side. The Ammerlin stood calmly looking at a rent in her sleeve. Blood slowly stained the gray silk. A woman screamed, and abruptly the courtyard rang with cries and shouts. The people on the walls milled furiously, and every man in the courtyard had his sword out. Even Rand, he was surprised to realize. Agumar shook his blade at the sky.
"Find him!" he roared. "Bring him to me!"
His face went from red to white when he saw the blood on the Ammerlin's sleeve. He fell to his knees, head bowed.
"Forgive me, mother. I have failed your safety. I am ashamed."
"Nonsense, Agumar," the Ammerlin said. "Lyanna, stop fussing over me and see to that man. I've cut myself worse than this, more than once, cleaning fish. And he needs help now. Agumar, stand up. Stand up, Lord of Faldara. You have not failed me, and you have no reason for shame. Last year in the White Tower, with my own guards at every gate and warders all around me, a man with a knife came within 5 steps of me. A white cloak, no doubt, though I've no proof. Please stand up, or I will be ashamed.
As Aglamar slowly rose, she fingered her sliced sleeve.
A poor shot for a white cloak bowman, or even a dark friend.
Her eyes flickered up to touch Rand's.
If it was at me, he aimed.
Her gaze was gone before he could read anything on her face, but he suddenly wanted to dismount and hide.
It wasn't aimed at her, and she knows it.
Lyanna straightened from where she had been kneeling. Someone had laid a cloak over the face of the man who had taken the arrow.
He is dead, Mother.
She sounded tired.
He was dead when he struck the ground. Even if I had been at his side, you did what you could, daughter. Death cannot be healed.
Aglamar moved closer.
Mother, if there are white cloak killers about or dark friends, you must allow me to send men with you. As far as the river, at least. I could not live if harm came to you in Shinar. Please return to the women's apartments. I will see them guarded with my life until you are ready to travel.
Be at ease, she told him. This scratch will not delay me a moment. Yes, yes, I will gladly accept your men as far as the river, if you insist. But I will not let this delay Lord Ingtar a moment either. Every heartbeat counts until the horn is found again.
Your leave, Lord Aglamar, to order your oathmen? He bowed his head in assent. At that moment, he would have given her Faldara had she asked. The Armalan turned back to Ingtar, and the men gathered behind him. She did not look at Rand again. He was surprised to see her smile suddenly.
I wager Ilion does not give its great hunt of the horn so rousing a send-off, she said. But yours is the true great hunt. You are few, so you may travel quickly, yet enough to do what you must. I charge you, Lord Ingtar of House Shinoa. I charge all of you. Find the Horn of Valir, and let nothing bar your way.
Ingtar whipped his sword from his back and kissed the blade.
By my life and soul, by my house and honor, I swear it, Mother.
Then ride.
Ingtar swung his horse toward the gate. Rand dug his heels into Red's flanks and galloped after the column already disappearing through the gates. Unaware of what had occurred within, the Armorland's pikemen and archers stood walling a path from the gates to the city proper, the flame of Tarvalin on their chests. Her drummers and trumpeters waited near the gates, ready to fall in when she left. Behind the rows of armored men, people packed the square in front of the keep. Some cheered Ingtar's banner, and others no doubt thought this was the start of the Armorland seat's departure. A swelling roar followed Rand across the square. He caught up with Ingtar, where low-eaved houses and shops stood to either side, and more people thickly lined the stone-paved street. Some of them cheered, too. Matt and Perrin had been riding at the head of the column with Ingtar and Loyal, but the two of them fell back when Rand joined them.
How am I ever going to apologize if they won't stay near me long enough for me to say anything? Burn me, he doesn't look like he's dying.
Chengu and Adao are gone, Ingtar said abruptly.
He sounded cold and angry, but shaken, too.
We counted every head in the keep, alive or dead, last night and again this morning. They are the only ones not accounted for.
Chengu was on guard in the dungeon yesterday, Rand said slowly.
And Nidao. They had the second watch. They always stayed together, even if they had to trade or do extra duty for it. They were not on guard when it happened, but they fought at Tarwin's Gap a month ago and saved Lord Aglamar when his horse went down with Trollocs all around him. Now this. Dark friends.
He drew a deep breath.
Everything is breaking apart.
A man on horseback forced his way through the throng lining the street and joined in behind Ingtar. He was a townsman, by his clothes, lean, with a lined face and graying hair cut long. A bundle and water bottles were lashed behind his saddle, and a short-bladed sword and a notched sword-breaker hung at his belt, along with a cudgel. Ingtar noticed Rand's glances.
This is Hurin, our sniffer. There was no need to let the Aes Sedai know about him. Not that what he does is wrong, you understand. The king keeps a sniffer in Falmorin, and there's another in Angkor Dail. It's just that Aes Sedai seldom like what they do not understand, and with him being a man, it's nothing to do with the power, of course. Ah, you tell him, Hurin.
Yes, Lord Ingtar, the man said.
He bowed low to Rand from his saddle.
Honored to serve, my lord.
Call me Rand. Rand stuck out his hand, and after a moment, Hurin grinned and took it.
As you wish, my lord Rand. Lord Ingtar and Lord Khajan don't mind a man's ways, and Lord Agamar, of course. But they say in the town you're an outland prince from the south, and some outland lords are strict for every man in his place.
I'm not a lord. At least I'll get away from that now. Just Rand. Hurin blinked.
As you wish, my lord, Rand. I'm a sniffer, you see. Been one 4 years this Sunday. I never heard of such a thing before then, but I hear there's a few others like me. It started slow, catching bad smells where nobody else smelled anything, and it grew. Took a whole year before I realized what it was. I could smell violence, the killing and the hurting. Smell where it happened, smell the trail of those who did it. Every trail's different, so there's no chance of mixing them up. Lord Ingtar heard of it, and took me in his service to serve the king's justice.
You can smell violence, Rand said. He could not help looking at the man's nose. It was an ordinary nose, not large, not small.
You mean you can really follow somebody who, say, killed another man by smell? I can that, my lord, Rand. It fades with time, but the worse the violence, the longer it lasts. I can smell a battlefield 10 years old, though the trails of the men who were there are gone. Up near the Blight, the trails of the Trollocs almost never fade. Not much to a Trolloc but killing and hurting. A fight in a tavern, though, with maybe a broken arm, that smell's gone in hours.
I can see where you wouldn't want Aes Sedai to find out.
Ah, Lord Ingtar was right about the Aes Sedai, the light illumine them. Rand. There was one in Kyrian once, Brown Adja, but I swear I thought she was red before she let me go. She kept me a month trying to find out how I do it. She didn't like not knowing. She kept muttering, "Is it old come again or new?" and staring at me until you would have thought I was using the one power. Almost had me doubting myself. But I haven't gone mad, and I don't do anything. I just smell it.
Rand could not help remembering Moraine. Old barriers weaken. There is something of dissolution and change about our time. Old things walk again and new things are born. We may live to see the end of an age. He shivered. So we'll track those who took the horn with your nose.
Ingtar nodded. Hurin grinned proudly and said,
We will that, Rand. I followed a murderer to Kyrian once, and another all the way to Moradon, to bring them back for the king's justice.
His grin faded, and he looked troubled.
This is the worst ever, though. Murder smells bad, and the trail of a murderer stinks with it. But this...
His nose wrinkled.
There were men in it last night. Dark friends must be, but you can't tell a dark friend by smell. What I'll follow is the Trollocs and the Half-Men, and something even worse.
He trailed off, frowning and muttering to himself. But Rand could hear it.
Something even worse, the light helped me.
They reached the city gates, and just beyond the walls, Hurin lifted his face to the breeze. His nostrils flared, then he gave a snort of disgust.
That way, my lord Ingtar.
He pointed south. Ingtar looked surprised.
Not toward the Blight? No, lord Ingtar. Fah!
Hurin wiped his mouth on his sleeve.
I can almost taste them. South they went.
She was right then, the Amalan Seat, Ingtar said slowly. A great and wise woman who deserves better than me to serve her. Take the trail, Hurin.
Rand turned and peered back through the gates up the street to the keep. He hoped Egwene was all right.
Nynaeve will look after her. Maybe it's better this way, like a clean cut, too quick to hurt till after it's done.
He rode after Ingtar and the Grey Owl banner south. The wind was making up and cold against his back despite the sun. He thought he heard laughter in it, faint and mocking. The waxing moon lit the humid, night-dark streets of Ilion, which still rang with celebration left over from daylight. In only a few more days, the great hunt of the horn would be sent forth with pomp and ceremony that tradition claimed dated to the Age of Legends.
The festivities for the hunters had blended into the Feast of Tevin, with its famed contests and prizes for gleemen. The greatest prize of all, as always, would go for the best telling of the Great Hunt of the Horn. Tonight the gleemen entertained in the palaces and mansions of the city, where the great and mighty disported themselves, and the hunters came from every nation to ride out and find, if not the Horn of Valir itself, at least immortality in song and story. They would have music and dancing, and fans and ices to dispel the year's first real heat. But carnival filled the streets, too, in the moon-bright, muggy night. Every day was a carnival until the hunt departed, and every night. People ran past Bale Doman in masks and costumes bizarre and fanciful, many showing too much flesh. Shouting and singing they ran, a half dozen together, then scattered pairs giggling and clutching each other, then 20 in a raucous knot. Fireworks crackled in the sky, gold and silver bursts against the black. There were almost as many illuminators in the city as there were gleemen. Doman spared little thought for fireworks or for the hunt. He was on his way to meet men he thought might be trying to kill him. He crossed the Bridge of Flowers over one of the city's many canals into the perfumed quarter, the port district of Ilion. The canal smelled of too many chamber pots, with never a sign that there had ever been flowers near the bridge. The quarter smelled of hemp and pitch from the shipyards and docks, and sour harbor mud, all of it made fiercer by heated air that seemed nearly damp enough to drink. Doman breathed heavily. Every time he returned from the North Country, he found himself surprised, for all he had been born there, at the early summer heat in Ilion. In one hand he carried a stout cudgel, and the other hand rested on the hilt of the short sword he had often used in defending the decks of his river trader from brigands. No few footpads stalked these nights of revelry, where the pickings were rich and most were deep in wine. Yet he was a broad, muscular man, and none of those out for a catch of gold thought him rich enough, in his plain-cut coat, to risk his size and his cudgel. The few who caught a clear glimpse of him, when he passed through light spilling from a window, edged back till he was well past. Dark hair that hung to his shoulders and a long beard that left his upper lip bare framed a round face, but that face had never been soft, and now it was set as grimly as if he meant to batter his way through a wall. He had men to meet, and he was not happy about it. More revelers ran past singing off-key, wine mangling their words. "The Horn of Valir, my aged grandmother," Doman thought glumly. "It be my ship I do want to hang on to, and my life, fortune prick me." He pushed into an inn under a sign of a big, white-striped badger dancing on its hind legs with a man carrying a silver shovel. Easing the Badger, it was called, though not even Nita Sidoro, the innkeeper, knew what the name meant. There had always been an inn of the name in Ilion. The common room, with sawdust on the floor, and a musician softly strumming a 12-stringed bittern in one of the sea folk's sad songs, was well lighted and quiet. Nita allowed no commotion in her place, and her nephew, Billy, was big enough to carry a man out with either hand. Sailors, dock workers, and warehousemen came to the Badger for a drink and maybe a little talk, for a game of stones or darts. The room was half full now. Even men who liked quiet had been lured out by carnival. The talk was soft, but Doman caught mentions of the hunt and of the false dragon the Mirandians had taken, and of the one the Tyrens were chasing through Haddon Merc. There seemed to be some question whether it would be preferable to see the false dragon die or the Tyrens. Doman grimaced.
"False dragons. Fortune prick me. There be no place safe these days."
But he had no real care for false dragons, any more than for the hunt. The stout proprietress, with her hair rolled at the back of her head, was wiping a mug, keeping a sharp eye on her establishment. She did not stop what she was doing, or even look at him, really. But her left eyelid drooped, and her eyes slanted toward three men at a table in the corner. They were quiet, even for the Badger, almost somber, and their bell-shaped velvet caps and dark coats, embroidered across the chest in bars of silver and scarlet and gold, stood out among the plain dress of the other patrons. Doman sighed and took a table in a corner by himself.
"Carienin this time."
He took a mug of brown ale from a serving girl and drew a long swallow. When he lowered the mug, the three men in striped coats were standing beside his table. He made an unobtrusive gesture to let Nita know that he did not need Billy.
"Captain Doman,"
They were all three nondescript, but there was an air about the speaker that made Dillman take him for their leader. They did not appear to be armed. Despite their fine clothes, they looked as if they did not need to be. There were hard eyes in those so very ordinary faces.
"Captain Bale Dillman, of the Spray."
Dillman gave a short nod, and the three sat down without waiting for an invitation. The same man did the talking, the other two just watch, hardly blinking. Guards, Dillman thought, for all their fine clothes. Who do he be to have a pair of guards to look over him?
"Captain Dillman, we have a personage who must be brought from Mayen to Ilion."
"Spray be a river craft," Dillman cut him off. "Her draft be shallow, and she has no keel for deep water."
It was not exactly true, but close enough for landsmen. At least it'd be a change from Tyr. They'd be getting smarter. The man seemed unperturbed at the interruption.
"We had heard you were giving up the river trade."
"Maybe I do, and maybe no. I have no decided."
He had, though. He would not go back up river, back to the borderlands for all the silk shipped in Tyran bottoms. Solday in furs and ice peppers were not worth it, and it had nothing to do with the false dragon he had heard of there. But he wondered again how anyone knew. He had not spoken of it to anyone, yet the others had known too.
"You can coast to Mayen easily enough. Surely, Captain, you would be willing to sail along the shoreline for 1,000 gold marks.
Despite himself, Dillman goggled. It was 4 times the last offer, and that had been enough to make a man's jaw drop.
"Who do you want me to fetch for that? The first of Mayen herself? Has Tyr finally forced her all the way out, then?"
"You need no names, Captain."
The man set a large leather pouch on the table and a sealed parchment. The pouch clinked heavily as he pushed them across the table. The big red wax circle holding the folded parchment shut bore the many-rayed Rising Sun of Kyrian.
200 on account. For 1,000 marks, I think you need no names. Give that, seal unbroken, to the port captain of Mayen, and he will give you 300 more and your passenger. I will hand over the remainder when your passenger is delivered here, so long as you have made no effort to discover that personage's identity.
Dillman drew a deep breath.
Fortune, it be worth the voyage, if there be never another penny beyond what be in that sack.
And 1,000 was more money than he could clear in 3 years. He suspected that if he probed a little more, there would be other hints, just hints, that the voyage involved hidden dealings with Ilion's Council of Nine and the First of Mayen. The First's city-state was a province of Tyr in all but name, and she would no doubt like Ilion's aid. And there were many in Ilion who said it was time for another war, that Tyr was taking more than a fair share of the trade on the Sea of Storms. A likely net to snare him, if he had not seen 3 like it in the past month. He reached to take the pouch, and the man who had done all the talking caught his wrist. Dillman glared at him, but he looked back undisturbed.
"You must sail as soon as possible, Captain."
"At first light,"
Dillman growled, and the man nodded and released his hold.
"At first light, then, Captain Dillman. Remember, discretion keeps a man alive to spend his money."
Dillman watched the 3 of them leave, then stared sourly at the pouch and the parchment on the table in front of him. Someone wanted him to go east. Tyr or Mayen, it did not matter so long as he went east. He thought he knew who wanted it.
"And then again, I have no a clue to them."
Who could know who was a dark friend? But he knew that dark friends had been after him since before he left Maraban, to come back downriver. Dark friends and Trollocs. Of that he was sure. The real question, the one he had not even a glimmer of an answer for, was why.
"Trouble, Bale?" Nita asked. "You do look as if you had seen a Trolloc."
She giggled, an improbable sound from a woman her size. Like most people who had never been to the Borderlands, Nita did not believe in Trollocs. He had tried telling her the truth of it. She enjoyed his stories and thought they were all lies. She did not believe in snow, either.
"No trouble, Nita."
He untied the pouch, dug a coin out without looking, and tossed it to her.
Drinks for everyone till that do run out. Then I'll give you another.
Nita looked at the coin in surprise.
A Tarvalen mark? Do you be trading with the witches now, Bale?
No, he said hoarsely. That I do not.
She bit the coin, then quickly snugged it away behind her broad belt.
Well, it'd be gold for that. And I suspect the witches be no so bad as some make them out anyway. I no say so much to many men. I know a money changer who do handle such. You'll no have to give me another with as few as be here tonight. More ale for you, Bale.
He nodded numbly, though his mug was still almost full, and she trundled off. She was a friend and would not speak of what she had seen. He sat staring at the leather pouch. Another mug was brought before he could make himself open it enough to look at the coins inside. He stirred them with a calloused finger. Gold marks glittered up at him in the lamplight, every one of them bearing the damning flame of Tarvalen. Hurriedly, he tied the bag. Dangerous coins. One or two might pass, but so many would say to most people exactly what Nita thought. There were children of the light in the city, and although there was no law in Ilion against dealing with Aes Sedai, he would never make it to a magistrate if the White Cloaks heard of this. These men had made sure he would not simply take the gold and stay in Ilion. While he was sitting there worrying, Yaren Maladan, his brooding stork-like second on spray, came into the Badger with his brows pulled down to his long nose and stood over the captain's table.
Karn's dead, Captain.
Doman stared at him, frowning. Three others of his men had already been killed, one each time he refused a commission that would take him east. The magistrates had done nothing. The streets were dangerous at night, they said, and sailors a rough and quarrelsome lot. Magistrates seldom troubled themselves with what happened in the perfumed quarter, as long as no respectable citizens were injured.
But this time I did accept them, he muttered.
"'Tisn't all, Captain, Yaren said. They worked Karn with knives, like they wanted him to tell them something. And some more men tried to sneak aboard Spray not an hour gone. The dock watch ran them off. Third time in 10 days. And I never knew war threats to be so persistent. They like to let an alarm die down before they try again. And somebody tossed my room at the Silver Dolphin last night. Took some silver, so I'd think it was thieves, but they left that belt buckle of mine, the one set with garnets and moonstones, lying right out in plain sight. What's going on, Captain? The men are afraid, and I'm a little nervous myself.
Doman reared to his feet.
Rouse the crew, Yaren. Find them and tell them Spray sails as soon as there do be men enough aboard to handle her.
Stuffing the parchment into his coat pocket, he snatched up the bag of gold and pushed his second out the door ahead of him.
Rouse them, Yaren, for I'll leave any man who no makes it, standing on the quay as he is.
Doman gave Yaren a shove to start him running, then stalked off toward the docks. Even footpads who heard the clinking of the pouch he carried steered clear of him, for he walked now like a man going to do murder. There were already crewmen scrambling aboard Spray when he arrived, and more running barefoot down the stone quay. They did not know what he feared was pursuing him, or even that anything did pursue him, but they knew he made good profits, and after the Ilioner way, he gave shares to the crew. Spray was 80 feet long, with 2 masts and broad in beam, with room for deck cargo as well as in the holds. Despite what Doman had told the Kyrianen, if they had been Kyrianen, he thought she could stand the open water. The Sea of Storms was quieter in the summer.
She'll have to, he muttered,
and strode below to his cabin. He tossed the sack of gold on his bed, built neatly against the hull like everything else in the stern cabin, and dug out the parchment. Lighting a lantern, hanging its swivel from the overhead, he studied the sealed document, turning it as if he could read what was inside without opening it. A rap on the door made him frown.
Come!
Yaren stuck his head in.
They're all aboard but 3 I couldn't find, Captain. But I've spread the word through every tavern, hell, and crib in the quarter. They'll be aboard before it's light enough to start upriver. Spray do sail now. To sea.
Doman cut off Yaren's protests about light and tides, and Spray not being built for the open sea.
Now! Spray can clear the bars at dead low tide. You've no forgotten how to sail by the stars, have you? Take her out, Yaren. Take her out now and come back to me when we be beyond the breakwater.
His second hesitated, Dumman never let a tricky bit of sailing pass without him on deck giving orders, and taking spray out in the night would be all of that, shallow draft or no. Then nodded and vanished. In moments, the sounds of Yaren shouting orders and bare feet thumping on the decks overhead penetrated Doman's cabin. He ignored them, even when the ship lurched, catching the tide. Finally, he lifted the mantle of the lantern and stuck a knife into the flame. Smoke curled up as oil burned off the blade, but before the metal could turn red, he pushed charts out of the way and pressed the parchment flat on his desk, working the hot steel slowly under the sealing wax. The top fold lifted. It was a simple document, without preamble or salutation, and it made sweat break out on his forehead. "The bearer of this is a dark friend wanted in Kyrian for murders and other foul crimes, least among them theft from our person. We call upon you to seize this man and all things found in his keeping to the smallest. Our representative will come to carry away what he has stolen from us. Let all he possesses, save what we claim, go to you as reward for taking him. Let the vile miscreant himself be hanged immediately, that his shadow-spawned villainy no longer taint the light. Sealed by our hand, Galdrian Suryatin Re, King of Kyrian, defender of the Dragon Wall." In thin red wax below the signature were impressed the rising sun seal of Kyrian and the five stars of House Riotin.
"Defender of the Dragon Wall, my aged grandmother," Doman croaked. "Fine right the man do have to call himself that any longer."
He examined the seals and signature minutely, holding the document close to the lamp, with his nose all but brushing the parchment. But he could find no flaw in the one, and for the other he had no idea what Galdrian's hand looked like. If it was not the king himself who had signed it, he suspected that whoever had, it made a good imitation of Galdrian's scrawl. In any case, it made no real difference. In Tyr, the letter would be instantly damning in the hands of any Ilioner. Or in Mayen, with Tyran influence so strong. There was no war now, and men from either port came and went freely, but there was as little love for Ilioners in Tyr as the other way round, especially with an excuse like this. For a moment, he thought of putting the parchment into the lantern's flame. It was a dangerous thing to have, in Tyr or Ilion or anywhere he could imagine. But finally, he tucked it carefully into a secret cubbyhole behind his desk, concealed by a panel only he knew how to open.
"My possessions, eh?"
He collected old things as much as he could living on shipboard. What he could not buy because it was too expensive or too large, he collected by seeing and remembering. All those remnants of times gone, those wonders scattered around the world that had first pulled him aboard a ship as boy. He had added four to his collection in Maradon this last trip, and it had been then that the Dark Friend pursuit began. And Trollocs, too, for a time. He had heard that Whitebridge had been burned to the ground right after he sailed from there, and there had been rumors of Murdral as well as Trollocs. It was that, all of it together, that had first convinced him he was not imagining things, that had had him on guard when that first odd commission was offered, too much money for a simple voyage to Tyr, and a thin tale for a reason. Digging into his chest, he set out on the desk what he had bought in Maradon. A light stick, left from the Age of Legends, or so it was said. Certainly no one knew the making of them any longer. Expensive, that, and rarer than an honest magistrate. It looked like a plain glass rod, thicker than his thumb, and not quite as long as his forearm. But when held in the hand, it glowed as brightly as a lantern. Light sticks shattered like glass, too. He had nearly lost spray in the fire caused by the first he had owned. A small, age-dark ivory carving of a man holding a sword. The fellow who sold it claimed if you held it long enough, you started to feel warm. Doman never had, and neither had any of the crew he let hold it. But it was old, and that was enough for Doman. The skull of a cat as big as a lion, and so old it was turned to stone. But no lion had ever had fangs, almost tusks, a foot long. And a thick disc the size of a man's hand, half white and half black, a sinuous line separating the colors. The shopkeeper in Maradon had said it was from the Age of Legends, thinking he lied. But Doman had haggled only a little before paying, because he recognized what the shopkeeper did not. the ancient symbol of Aes Sedai from before the breaking of the world. Not a safe thing to have, precisely, but neither a thing to be passed up by a man with a fascination for the old. And it was Heartstone. The shopkeeper had never dared add that to what he thought were lies. No riverfront shopkeeper in Maradon could afford even one piece of Quendiyar. The disc felt hard and smooth in his hand, and not at all valuable except for its age. But he was afraid it was what his pursuers were after. Light sticks and ivory carvings and even bones turned to stone he had seen other times, other places. Yet even knowing what they wanted, if he did know, he still had no idea why, and he could no longer be sure who his pursuers were. Tarvalin marks and an ancient Aes Sedai symbol. He scrubbed a hand across his lips. The taste of fear lay bitter on his tongue. A knock at the door. He set the disc down and pulled an unrolled chart over what lay on his desk.
Come!
Yaren entered.
We're beyond the breakwater, Captain.
Doman felt a flash of surprise, then anger with himself. He should never have gotten so engrossed that he failed to feel spray lifting on the swells.
Make west, Yaren. See to it.
A Budar, Captain.
No far enough. No by 500 leagues.
We'll put in long enough for me to get charts and top the water barrels. Then we do sail west.
West, Captain? Tremalking?
The seafolk are tight with any traders but their own. The Arath Ocean, Yaren. Plenty of trade between Taraban and Arad Doman, and hardly a Tarabaner or Domani bottom to worry about. They do not like the sea, I have heard. And all those small towns on Toman Head, every one holding itself free of any nation at all. We can even pick up Saldae and furs and ice peppers brought down to Bandar Eban.
Yaren shook his head slowly. He always looked at the dark side, but he was a good sailor.
Furs and peppers will cost more than running up river for them, Captain. And I hear there's some kind of war. If Taraban and Arad Doman are fighting, there may be no trade. I doubt we'll make much off the towns on Toman Head alone, even if they are safe. Falmer's the largest, and it is not big. The Taraboners and the Domani have always squabbled over Almuth Plain and Toman Head. Even if it has come to blows this time, a careful man can always find trade. West, Yaren.
When Yaren had gone topside, Doman quickly added the black and white disc to the cubbyhole and stowed the rest back in the bottom of his chest.
Dark friends or Aes Sedai, I'll no run the way they want me. Fortune prick me, I'll know.
Feeling safe for the first time in months, Doman went on deck as spray heeled to catch the wind and put her bow west into the night-dark sea.